But there's some things I don't like to admit, especially from the pulpit. But I will anyway if it affords me a good sermon illustration, okay? So here goes one. I used to be a big Seinfeld fan, okay? You ever hear of Jerry Seinfeld? I suppose most of you probably have. Now, those who have never watched Jerry Seinfeld's TV show, I have two things to say to you. One, I commend you for not stooping that low to expose yourself to that kind of mind-numbing entertainment, okay? That's just, I mean, this went on for decades, okay, that he was. And so I just say, I thank God that you're more spiritual than me, okay, because I watched it, and I, you know, I'm not proud to say that, but I did. And so, number two, if you don't know Jerry Seinfeld, then don't worry, the mothership will come and pick you up soon, okay, and take you back to the planet where you're from, because I think everybody knows about the Seinfeld show. I suppose that one of the reasons I enjoyed watching the show, because I could relate to some of the behaviors of the quirky characters on the show. And that made me laugh. I don't know about you guys, but I like a good laugh. Everybody like a good laugh? I know I do. I like to laugh every day if I can. They say laughter is good medicine. You remember in the Reader's Digest that always had the section in there? So I'm really aging myself here, right? Because do they do Reader's Digest anymore? They probably still do. It's probably in bold print. I should get it in big bold print now, but back then, you know, I didn't read much of it. Sometimes there's an article I like, but I always says, laughter, the best medicine, or something like that. So laughing is a good thing. Everybody agree that, right? Everybody, okay, I got some nods out there, good. Michael Ramsay, an early Archbishop of Canterbury, okay? So we're taking ourselves a few centuries ago. He gave some advice to a group of men who were just finishing up their ordination, and they were going to be pastors in the ministry. And one of the things he said, now remember, this is kind of back when maybe people didn't laugh as much, okay? They're much more serious about things. He said, use your sense of humor. Laugh about things. Laugh at the absurdity of life, he said. Laugh about yourself. You know, don't take yourself so seriously sometimes. Laugh about your own absurdity. We are all of us infinitesimally small and ludicrous creatures within God's universe. That's what he said. That's what one of the pieces of advice he gave to these beginning pastors. And that's true. At the same time, God still loves us, even though, you know, we may feel infinitesimally small. I mean, just think about the universe, how it's expanding right now, and yet God would know us personally, individually, lovingly. But in my mind, most episodes of Seinfeld just sort of blend together, okay? Once you've seen one, you've seen them all, and except for, there's a couple of famous lines in there, like, no soup for you. You remember the one guy who was would not serve George Costanza his soup, okay? There was that. Or Kramer said, these pretzels are making me thirsty. Okay, these are things that kind of stick in my mind. I'm sorry, that's valuable space in my head, and unfortunately that's in there, but what can I do? I have a hard time distinguishing one episode from another, but because after all, they always said it was a show about nothing, right? So I was filling my brain with nothing. But one of the shows that really caught my attention wasn't so much the content as it was how they did the show. And how they did it is they did it in reverse. Instead of doing, you know, your typical show where you start at the beginning of the, and you start the story, and then it goes to the end, the culmination, to the end, it didn't do that. Instead, it started with the culmination, the end of the show, and worked itself backwards to the beginning. Okay. Are you with me so far? Okay, good. I'm just kind of wondering here. Okay. There was another TV show out there. It was called, I'm trying to make an analogy here. Okay, it was called 24. You remember this? But now I'm really aging myself here. 24. Remember that? Kiefer Sutherland, and he was going to save the world basically every episode, okay? But here's the interesting thing about that show is that every episode was 1 hour in the life of this actor, Kiefer Sutherland. Remember him? Anyway. And he would always save the world or save the country with just moments to spare, seconds to spare. Think of Mission Impossible, right? Okay, everybody knows the Mission Impossible and everything, right down to the very end, the last thing would happen. I guess we like those sorts of movies. I do anyway. But they couldn't have done that show backwards. How would that have worked? They could have never done it because if they had the culmination at the beginning of the show, everybody would turn the TV off and we wouldn't watch it anymore. Because we already know the ending. Not so with Seinfeld. As a matter of fact, the exact opposite happened. Seeing Jerry and his friends in a foreign country, they were in India on this occasion, and it made me wonder what crazy events must have happened that to get them all the way over there to India. And so the hook was set. Any fishermen out there, you know what that means, the hook is set? So you just kind of, you bait the hook and you put it out there and you see what bites. Now I had to watch the episode so I could see the dots connect. And that's kind of what my message is about, connecting the dots. As many of you are aware, summer has officially started, and you know what that means. It means that there generally will be a downtick in church attendance, right? That's just the way it goes, right? Many people are traveling. They're taking vacations. They're visiting family who live out of state. And even my family will be gone for a couple Sundays. So it may be a while before we see each other again. Maybe we'll never see each other again. Maybe when we go to Canada, we won't be able to get across the border again. I don't know what's going to happen. Julie, I'm sure, is worried about that. I'm not too worried about that, but she'll make sure all our passports are in line and that we get across the border and back. But we don't know what the future holds. So in the meantime, I want to make sure I leave you with something that will help you connect the dots concerning your faith. And the reason I want to do this is because I want to see everybody back here in the fall. Okay, you know, I'm going to go on vacation. You probably go on vacation. Well, you know, we'll be like two ships passing in the night. We may not see each other for a while. And sometimes during the summer, when we want to do so much, when the weather is good, I can understand, we want to have camping, we want to have bonfires, we want to go do this and that, maybe go see a baseball game. We might start getting out of the habit of going to church. Anybody ever do that? Everybody ever get out of the habit of going to church? That happened to me way back. Well, I wasn't even a Christian then, and I got out of the habit, and for many years, give me at least a decade or so, I got out of the habit of going to church. I would much rather sit home and watch All-Star Wrestling, back when they had All-Star Wrestling, but that's another story for another time. But we can get out of the habit of going to church. And this, mind you, would not be good. And one of the reasons we might stop going to church is we forget why we went to church in the first place. We may have lost in our mind the reason, why do I do this? Why do I go to such hassle to get up in the morning and get, you know, get presentable? You got to do that, and maybe you got to take your pills, or you know, do all this sorts of stuff. And all of a sudden, you think about, oh, this is a big hassle. I got to get my kids ready. Oh, I remember those years when we actually had to hire someone to get our kids ready for church because we had a quiver load of kids, right? So Julie, that was too hard for her to get them all ready to go because they couldn't get themselves ready yet. And so we actually had a lady, very nice, wonderful lady back in Montana who helped get the kids ready and marched them off to church, which was only a couple blocks away, but still. She did that for us. But what are some of the reasons people get out of the habit of going to church? Could be health issues. Sometimes people, you know, it's just too difficult because of the things they're going through physically that they can't go to church. Maybe there's a job change, and because of that kind of throws your world into the spin cycle, so to speak. Maybe you couldn't find a church nearby where you know that you really connected with the other people. The list goes on, and some of the reasons can be legitimate reasons. For a season, and And they just got out of the habit of going to church. It happens. But here's what I want to say to you. Never let the reason for not going to church be that you failed to connect the dots concerning your faith. In other words, don't stop attending church because you have somehow confused or are confused about the most important event that happened in human history, and that is namely the resurrection of Jesus, the death and resurrection of Christ. If you forget that reason, then you will wonder, why am I going to church? It doesn't make sense. Think about this for a second. What if you were an unchurched person? Let's say you've been away from church for, say, let's say 10 years. Maybe even more, 20 years. I don't know. And for some miracle, you show up at church. Maybe you're invited. Who knows? What would you experience at church? First, I hope you would feel the presence of God. I mean, when new people come into church, I want them to experience the presence of God above all things, more than anything else. But that may not be the case when they come. You probably would meet some nice people who are welcoming, I hope, but I wouldn't guarantee it. Sometimes you can go to church and people won't even bother greeting you or saying hi to you. That can be kind of disappointing. And probably during the sermon, you may hear some words that, a bunch of big words you maybe never have heard for a while. Things like resurrection of the redeemed, for example. You know, like that almost sounds like a good video game. Resurrection of the redeemed. Could you see? Ooh, kids liking that one. But my point in all this is to say that an unchurched person walking into a Sunday morning service, let's say it's Easter morning, because some people tend to wander into church on Easter sometimes, and it would be akin to walking into the middle of a TV show, not really knowing what's going on. There's a whole lot of action going on there, but you're left wondering, what is it all about? I don't want this to ever happen to you. I want you to know when you come into church what this is all about. I want you to connect the dots. Here's another example. So I'm a sports fan, okay? I mean, I've been much more of a sports fan in my life. I'm not so much anymore. I guess that may be a sign of that I'm maturing. But I'm still a fan. As a matter of fact, today I think there's a Game 7 of the NBA Finals. Now, in the past, I would have never missed that for anything. I would have been right there glued to the TV to see what was to be the outcome. Not so much anymore. I mean, I'll look and see who won or lost and that sort of thing, but I won't be so obsessed with it. But maybe you're with a friend who really is not, you're a sports fan and they're not a sports fan, okay? And the game comes down to the wire and there's a thrilling shot or something happens right at the end and the buzzer goes off and they say, what happened? It's like everyone's high-fiving and cheering and they know what's going on, but your friend doesn't know what's going on. That's a prime example of a failure to connect the dots. These, you know, they just weren't in tune with what was going on around them. I don't want anyone to leave on a Sunday morning, whether it's Easter Sunday, whether it's this morning. I don't want them to leave not connecting the dots until they have a chance to clearly understand what Christianity is all about. That's important for me. And as like I said, I'm going on vacation, okay? I'm not going to see you for 2 or 3 weeks. Maybe we'll never see each other again. Maybe the next time I see you, I will be on the other side in glory at that time. I don't know. It could happen. But what is Christianity about? Christianity isn't a list of rules or regulations. Let's get that out. It's not a list of do's and don'ts. Christianity is not a reward system that says if you do more right than wrong, probably you'll get your ticket punched into heaven. That's not what Christianity is about either. Christianity is not an organization or a club that one joins in order to somehow reap earthly benefits. I mean, we get earthly benefits from going to church and being in that network and that community and that family. We do benefit from that immensely, but that isn't the primary reason for church. No, Christianity, if I were to sum it up, it's God's one and only plan to help restore mankind's relation to himself. for God and man to come to a reconciliation, a restoration of their relationship with one another. That's what Christianity is all about. And do you know how Christians know that the plan of God is working in the world? That's a question. Sometimes we look at the world and we go, it's not working. The world is not working. Things are out of control. Things are spinning out of control. Things are unraveling at the seams. We got people protesting in the streets. We got the National Guard being called out. We've got smart bombs bunker busters being dropped on nations. And we might be saying to ourselves, things are not working as planned. Well, I'll tell you how we know it's working, and that is one word. It's called the resurrection. Christ's resurrection from the grave. Without Christ's bodily resurrection from the grave, Christianity would cease to exist. That's exactly what that scripture from 2 Corinthians today. Now think about this for a second. Can you name one person in the Gospels who actually believed Jesus Christ, besides Jesus himself, believed that Jesus would actually return to life again after being dead for 3 days? Does anybody, nobody in the New Testament believe that to begin with? Did Mary and the women who went to the tomb after Christ was tortured and put to death, did they go expecting Jesus to be alive? No, they didn't. They were bringing spices to embalm Jesus' dead body. The disciples, did they believe this? Hardly. They were running scared and hiding. How about those two guys traveling on the road to Emmaus? I don't think so. They were depressed. They had no hope or belief whatsoever that Jesus Christ would come back to life. It was not on the radar. These facts alone shoot holes in what sometimes is called you ever hear of the hallucination theory? That states that people only hallucinated Jesus' resurrection. But from my understanding, and I did a little bit of study on this, hallucinations are typically, people who have hallucinations are those who are looking for hallucinations. Okay? No one was looking for Jesus to live again. Besides, how does a hallucination theorist, how would they explain 500 people having the same hallucination at the very exact same time? Which is actually what happened. I mean, 500 people witnessed the risen Lord at one time. Now, I'll grant you this. No one, according to the Bible, ever witnessed Christ's resurrection. Do you understand that? No one was there. No human being was there. There might have been angels or something. No human being was there to see Christ become alive again at the grave, at the tomb. This fact, however, doesn't rule out the possibility that indeed it happened. As a matter of fact, we have three convincing lines of evidence that logically demonstrate that Christ was raised from the dead. And this is how I want to connect the dots. Number one, we have the empty tomb, correct? All four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, agree that Jesus' body was placed in a tomb after he was crucified, and 2 days later, after the tomb was empty. This is not a disputed fact. Even Jesus' enemies agreed that Jesus' body was gone. So where did it go? Where did Jesus' body go? Did the friends of Jesus take Jesus' body? Doubtful. The enemies of Jesus secured guards over the tomb to prevent any sort of grave robbing situation. And even more problematic for the skeptics is the point that the early disciples suffered from the preaching of the resurrection. If they had stolen the body, let's say the disciples somehow, miraculously, were able to get to the dead body of Jesus, and if they would have stolen it, do you think they would be ready to suffer and even go to their death saying that Jesus was raised again when in fact they knew completely opposite, not likely they wouldn't do that. The idea that Jesus' enemies, the second point, The idea that Jesus' enemies remove the body is a no better situation, okay? By taking Jesus' body, they would have actually encouraged resurrection stories, right? So if they had taken the story and nobody could find the body, obviously people would start saying, Jesus rose again from the grave because nobody could produce the body. But that would have... they would have produced something that they wanted to prevent. They didn't want stories going around about Jesus' resurrection. This would have proved the resurrection once and for all. As one scholar aptly wrote, the silence of the Jews, those who wanted Jesus dead, that's as significant as the speech of the Christians. The fact that the Jews did not say anything. So that's the first point, the empty tomb. Number two, we have post-resurrection appearances of Christ. So, there are, in the Bible, there are 5 written accounts tell of 10 different appearances after the resurrection. 5 on the first day, on Easter Sunday, 5 more spread over 40 days, and great variety exists among those witnesses. For one, the women. The women were the first ones to see the resurrected Lord. Now, this actually adds credence to the resurrection story. If it would have been a manufactured story, they probably wouldn't have mentioned the fact that the women had seen Jesus alive. Because, quite frankly, in that society, the woman's testimony was not given much credence. Josephus records this one rule. He says, from women let no evidence be accepted because of the levity and the temerity of the sex. So, sorry ladies out there, they didn't think too highly of your telling the truth, okay? But the fact of the matter is the Bible speaks about the women seeing Jesus alive first, which actually lends authority and credence to the truth of it. But Jesus also appeared not only to the women, he appeared once to one person, to 2 on the road to Emmaus, and to the 11, and to more than 500 people. And especially important is his appearance to Paul, who at that time was called Saul. And he was a very intelligent, well-educated man, but he had one problem. He had one big chip on his shoulder against the Christians, and he was out to persecute and to put a stop to the Christian religion. And he is emphatic in his writing that he witnessed the risen Christ and it altered the whole course of his life and, in fact, altered the course of Christianity itself in a sense that he was like the greatest missionary ever and preached the resurrected Lord. So the empty tomb, that's the first point. Number 2, we have the post-resurrection appearances of Christ. And 3, we have the experience and existence of the Christian church, of which we are all a part. The conviction that Jesus had risen from the dead transformed the first disciples, didn't it? These men who when the women told them that they were incredulous. They didn't believe what the women said when they came back from the tomb saying, "We have seen the Lord. He's alive." Luke records this. The words seemed to them an idle tale. They did not believe them. That's what Luke says. Yet these same people who did not believe shortly afterward risked imprisonment and death as they preached Jesus and the resurrection. Why such an astounding transformation? Well, we know why. It must have taken hard evidence to convince Peter and Thomas and eventually Paul. Yet they were convinced that Jesus had risen, that the people were, and they were so much so, they would be imprisoned and they would suffer death for their belief. That's very insignificant. You see, it's our human nature. When we are confronted with such perils as imprisonment or death or torture or things like that, we want to avoid the pain and the hardship. I might try to wiggle my way out of some sort of situation where I felt like I had, you know, to go to jail. I'm not a very, you know, maybe the Lord would work a miracle in me and I could do it. But when we are confronted with such perils, We seek to find alternate solutions, and we may not want to be so clear and say, hey, yes, I'm going to stand for my principles. But that's what they did, because they were sure of Christ's resurrection. Now, how about you? Are you sure of Christ's resurrection? And do you know what that would mean? What does that mean personally for you? Christ's resurrection means God exists and he's incredibly powerful. Think about that. He vanquished humanity's greatest enemy, sin and spiritual death on the cross. Christ destroyed the enemy, sin. His resurrection proves that he is a victor. So first, Christ's resurrection means that God exists and that he is incredibly powerful. Number two, Christ's resurrection means that God is personal and he's intimately involved in his creation. In fact, it says God became man. He became God incarnate. And he came and took on human appearance so that he could be the sacrificial lamb and voluntarily go to death. Why would God put himself in a position to die? He is the creator of the universe. He did so for you and me, writes Paul in Philippians. Though being the very nature of God, made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant so that he could experience death for us. That's his reason. Number three, Christ's resurrection shows that Jesus is holy and righteous. The Bible tells us the wages of sin is death. This is why death could not hold Christ in the grave. Christ is holy and he's righteous and did not deserve to die. He did not deserve to experience death, but he did it voluntarily. But the grave could not hold him. Number four, Christ's resurrection demonstrates he is worthy of our allegiance and our worship. And that's important to remember, because that is one of the fundamental reasons why we would take time out of our schedule. Well, we could do a lot of things right now. We could be out camping. We could be out, you know, fishing. I don't know, going to the donut shop, whatever. Christ's resurrection demonstrates he is definitely worthy of all our allegiance and worship. During his earthly ministry, Christ foretold his death and resurrection. Many times he alluded to it. He said, I am going to Jerusalem. I am going to be put to death by the religious authority. I'm going to be offering up my life. And he also mentioned that he was going to be, after 3 days, I will see you again. The fulfilling of those prophecies. Because Jesus was not only is the great shepherd and the king and the prophet and the priest. These fulfillings of prophecy, they put their stamp and approval on everything Jesus said. So if he said that, he said, I am going to die and raise again, and he did that, shouldn't we, and we take that seriously, we should take seriously all the other things he said in the New Testament. Jesus truly is God. He deserves all our praise and our worship. Hopefully this helps to connect some of the dots that you may have forgotten about. Sometimes they go back into the recesses of our mind and we forget about it. And you might ask yourself, why am I coming to church? Why am I taking this time out of my schedule? It's because of Christ and his amazing work, his voluntarily giving up of himself, dying on the cross, coming alive again. And not only coming alive to an earthly life, to ascend to the right hand of the Father, to be in continual intercession, which means prayer for us, requesting to the Father, reminding the Father, not that he needs reminding, but reminding God of his creation and his plan of salvation and his plan of reconciling the universe to himself. Because, yes, he's doing that for humanity, but he's also doing with that creation itself. That's a whole other sermon, though. Hopefully this connects some of the dots for you. And hopefully, one of those dots is in your heart, okay? So You ever see those interesting, where you see the stars, they have the star maps, and they have like constellations like Ursa Major and Ursa Minor, you know what those are, the Big Dipper and the Little Dipper and things like that. And sometimes you look at those and, now do I really see it up there in the sky? But if you connect the dots, you can say, ah, yes, I see it. I see that now. I want those dots to be connected, especially in that one dot connected in your heart.